Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Humanities Foundation titled Carlyle and the Morality of Exuberance. Our speaker is Columbia University Professor Simon Shama. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Humanities Foundation Director James Wynn.
Simon Shama's wide-ranging imaginative books, including The Embarrassment of Riches, Citizens, Dead Certainties, Landscape and Memory, Rembrandt's Eyes, and Rough Crossings, have communicated the thrill of historical discovery, the importance of analytical thinking, and the rewards of transgressing disciplinary boundaries to readers in all walks of life. Simon has also moved confidently into the other media with a prize-winning television series on the history of Britain and another on the power of art and even a radio program broadcast in England celebrating baseball and the Boston Red Sox. He is transatlantic, dividing his time between London and New York, multidisciplinary with appointments at Columbia in both history and art history, and the most voracious consumer of books, images, and ideas I have ever known. His topic today is Thomas Carlyle and the Morality of Exuberance. Please welcome Simon Shama.
Thank you so much, James. Very kind. Thank you all for coming. In 1831, Carlyle, out of loyalty to his new friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson, went to attend his lectures, but chaffed Emerson a little bit for reading from a prepared text, when Carlyle's own view about such things was, without terror, no life force in particular. But my own particular terror is the notion that Roger Shattuck's steel trap mind is somehow hovering over these proceedings. So the last thing I was going to do was to even attempt to emulate Carlyle and wing it into the celestial realms which Carlyle felt he often inhabited. I often give Carlyle, French Revolution, sometimes other works too, even a bit of Sartre or Brissatus, to students, to history students who are thinking about the relationship between language and memory. And once, I remember, probably not to be repeated, I set out on the seminar table the following passage, which you'll all recognize being from the great preface to his book on Cromwell. It's hard to know what to call it, really. It was meant to be a biography and then ended up, as you again all know, as an extraordinary sort of edition of Cromwell's letters and journal entries of documents. So here's Carlyle in the famous preface to Cromwell describing what it was like to encounter an archive of 17th century documents. "Dreariest continent of shot rubbish the eye ever saw, confusion piled on confusion to your utmost horizon's edge, obscure in lurid twilight as the shadow of death, trackless, without an idea, without fingerpost or mark of any human foregoer." This is just going into basically the public record office. "Where your human footstep, if you are still human, echoes bodeful through the gaunt solitude, peopled only by somnambulant pedants, dilettantes, and doleful creatures, by phantasms, errors, inconceivabilities, nightmares, norrows, griffins, wyverns, and chimeras dire." And the response of the first student I asked to that simply was, thunderstruck, what was left of the blood in his face disappearing from it, "What the hell was that?" he said. Which is more or less, I think, the response to the French Revolution of Carlyle's good friend, Thackeray, who described Carlylean prose as, Carlylean writing as, "prose run mad." And another moment, actually, Thackeray alluded to it as a kind of experiment. These weren't exactly his words. "Experiment in poetry. Prose poetry." Perhaps actually one of the things that Carlyle was after was an attempt to make the distinction between poetry and prose moot. That may be to have tried to create what we might think of as a Frankenstein of a genre, poetic nonfiction, but at any rate, a style of prose writing that performs some of the defining characteristics of verse and attention to cadence, some of the characteristics, to the sonorities of words, sentences leaping from syntax to do their own thing in aid of what Carlyle praised in Ruskin as melody of utterance and in another moment as poetic indignation. What bound Carlyle and Ruskin together as a minority of two, which was Carlyle's own characterization, was their impatience with what they felt to be the empty machinery of grammatical decorum. Such writing, very often, of course, the writing of their own critics, amounted, they thought, to a kind of literary embalming, a film laid over the raw vitality of history or painting. Both Ruskin, or at any rate the young Ruskin and Carlyle, struggled for years with what we might call the problem of translation, how to catch and fix subject matter without rendering it inert, doing justice to the original meant, they romantically thought, more than simply total immersion in their reality, but rather, certainly in Carlyle's case, I think, when he came to write The French Revolution, a sort of muscular reenactment in the same way that Ruskin very often wanted to actually shape or work his prose. Those of you familiar with those extremely strenuous descriptions of Tintoretto, for example, in Scuola di San Rocco, Ruskin's notion was that you could somehow reach behind the formal conventions of ekphrasis, of critical description, to actually reenact whatever heroic purpose, whatever heroic labor or enterprise was at work in creating that piece of art. The issue for both Carlyle and Ruskin was not so much that writing about history and art was second-hand, almost non-fiction, of course, even they would have agreed, shares that quality, but that reveling in the second-handedness was prized by the guardians of the trade as a model of the well-written report, the work well done. In that view, to be distant was to be elegant, trustworthy, sound, when, they believed, to be close was to be true. Their passion, then, I think, was engaged in a redefinition of clarity to replace the dependability of distance with the unreliable but more authentic experience, as they imagined it, of proximity. The clarity of distance proceeded, Carlyle believed, from the claimed superiority of hindsight. But he yearned to make the reader humble in the face of ultimately inscrutable providence, and thus recover through rude force the uncertain outcomes of history, and indeed art, to set the reader down on the edge of undetermined possibility. For Carlyle, and indeed for Ruskin, this was always more than a simply aesthetic challenge, to make readers exult, tremble, panic once more, whether in the workshop of Tintoretto or in the National Convention, was to rescue them from the besetting sin of intellectual complacency, history, once again, as the unfolding of inevitability. It was to also remake the historian's vocation as resistance to disappearance, the etiolation of human gesture into mouldy blank, as Carlyle beautifully put it when talking about the 17th century in that same preface to Cromwell. To put it another way, the written rules of the Johnsonian 18th century have been above all committed to transparency and harmony, the brute chaos of the world mastered as knowledge, that knowledge necessarily cool in its dispassion. What Ruskin and Carlyle wanted to generate was a different quality of knowledge, one that proceeded from total absorption in its subject to the point of letting go of the usual mechanics of perception. What was commonly taken to be vision, they believed, a form of organized comprehension, they believed, in a word that both Ruskin and Carlyle liked, to be owlish, a form of blindness, for it did no more than measure surfaces. It was not so much sight or perception as a kind of surveying. Though they revered the masters who had ventured freshly with language, Wordsworth and Coleridge above all, and with some reservations Hazlitt, they still felt that none of the conventions usually available were capable of pulling the reader into uncomfortable, attentive proximity, the abolition of body space between past and present, subject and object. On the other hand, if some sort of diction could be fashioned that attacked the mechanical, automatic quality of reading, the reader could yet be provoked into a kind of creative partnership with the writer, become sparring partners in a battle for the recovery and language of lived experience. Only that way, Carlyle believed, could what the dryer's dusts, as he referred to them, inheriting in a very peculiar and indirect way, as we'll see at the end, an invention of Walter Scott, only could that way was it possible to sort of rescue from the dry as dust the grand unintelligibility of the 17th century, in Carlyle's phrase, to make it once again audible. The writing that would do this work might itself be read confrontationally, heroically. Its scars and scrapes, nicks and cuts, all unapologetically registering the force of the travail needed to create it. In some sense, the rugged endeavor of the work itself was meant to be a moral exemplum for readers, the sort of painters who, again, Ruskin most admired, like Tintoretto. He celebrated for actually the imperfections, for sort of leaving the trace marks. Carlyle liked what Hazlitt had written about Rembrandt and Rembrandt's unapologetic deposit, really, of the traces of what Hazlitt and certainly Carlyle imagined to be the kind of rugged fury of what it had taken to produce this or that painting. For both of those Victorian writers, noble handwork, something which had finger mark on it, if you like, was the only salvation to a culture otherwise, of course, in thrall to the die stamp of the machine, the aim of which was necessarily and economically uniformity. Carlyle is always wanting as a preliminary tactic, it seems to me, to obliterate what he takes to be the mediocre, to burn through its defensive decorum. So it's not surprising to find that fire is the natural element of what he imagines to be a resurrection of the lost Gothic native vigour of Old English prose. When you read the French Revolution, you smell smoke. Images of fire, bituminous, carboniferous, lick through its pages. The world consumed by the revolution is, Carlyle writes, consumed in black ashes. Mirabeau is, long quote here, a fiery, fuligidous mass which could not be choked or smothered, but would fill all France with smoke. And now it has got air, it will burn its whole smoke substance, its whole smoke atmosphere too, and fill all France with flames. Paris doesn't just fall to the revolution in July 1789, it burns. Let conflagration rage of whatsoever is combustible. Guard rooms are burnt, invalide mess rooms, straw is burnt. Three cartloads of it hauled thither go up in white smoke, almost to the choking of patriotism itself, so that Elie, one of the besiegers, with singed eyebrows, had to drag back a cart. An entire chapter of the French Revolution is, for no particularly discernible reason, or certainly no reason the subsequent narrative clarifies, called flame pictures. Revolutionary events do not just happen, they ignite. And in the great climactic passage just before the onset of the terror, although those of you who know the French Revolution will know it has met more climaxes practically than the French Revolution as an event itself had, France becomes, in this great passage, just before the Jacobins take power, a kindled fire ship, in rather wonderful image, mad, wonderful image of Carlyle's. The Girondin, the Jacobin, here lay the bitumen stratum, there the brimstone one, so ran the vein of gunpowder, of nitre, terebinth, and foul grease. And certainly Carlyle thinks, or concentrates rather relentlessly, as you've heard, on this kind of genre. What critics habitually, and sometimes I think without quite sensing what they're doing, when they characterize Carlylean style as pyrotechnic, the simultaneous blazing forth of vehement heat and blinding light, springs from what we might want to call Carlyle's Presbyterian Zoroastrianism, if there isn't very mad Carlylean oxymoron, I suppose. But the sense, anyway, that fire is the element of destruction and rebirth. Remember, of course, he learned German in the first instance to learn geology. And it seems likely to me that in the great debate over the origins of the world, and in particular its mountains, Carlyle is very likely to have been a Vulcanist rather than a Neptunist. He loved it when metaphors turn material. So, naturally, he was among the large crowd, which included Ruskin's hero Turner, watching the Houses of Parliament burn down the evening and night of October the 16th, 1834. It was about a month after he'd begun work on the French Revolution. And on that particular day, he'd been working, as he tells us, reluctantly with the dry as dust in the British Museum, returning to Cheyne Row with his usual, what he described, museum headache. Looking from his back windows, he noticed the angry red glow, opened the windows, inhaled the acrid smoke, and then hurried off as fast as he could to the embankment. Though he heard some of the spectators complain, love this, very British, about the Houses of Parliament, but it didn't make a really good fire. It was certainly hot enough for Carlyle's, as of course for Turner's imagination, to see the incineration as a cleansing of the fetid sty of corruption from which, phoenix-like, some purer form of British constitution would duly arise. That the destruction of the house of old corruption had been caused by the burning of tally sticks, the record, as Carlyle saw it, of accumulated iniquity, only made it even better. It seemed likely, then, that he transferred that very flame picture he directly witnessed to the conflagration of the French monarchy. But even if Parliament hadn't burned, the French Revolution would have been a work of spontaneous literary combustion, because, of course, it did. Behind all of Carlyle's obsession with flames lay the trauma of his own manuscript being literally consumed by them. On the evening of March 6, 1835, John Stuart Mill, friend and kindly, if occasionally baffled, review editor, paid an unannounced late visit to Cheney Row along with his beloved Harriet Taylor and stood distraught on the doorstep, barely able to get any words out, even more unusual for Mill than it was for Carlyle. This nervous silence was understandable, since what he had to say was that the only manuscript version of Volume 1 of the French Revolution, the story right up to the flight to Varennes, had been accidentally destroyed by a maidservant at his, or possibly, it wasn't quite clear from what Mill said, Mrs. Taylor's house. The servant had apparently thought that the manuscript was fire-kindling. So Mill said. Now, it says a lot either for Carlyle's genuine affection for Mill, that he didn't think there was something a bit fishy about this account. Unfinished, it was still a mighty big chunk of papers, and how much do you actually need as fire kindling, even on a cold early spring night? Jane Walsh Carlyle had her suspicions that Harriet Taylor may have had a hand in this and that Mill was gallantly taking responsibility for the disaster. But they were rejected out of hand by Carlyle as unworthy and unlikely. Carlyle even, rather adorably, but I think a bit unconvincingly, claimed it had actually been a relief to hear what Mill had to say, because he'd initially thought that he'd come to announce he'd run off with Mrs. Taylor. That would have been much worse, so Carlyle says. Any rate, a night of great anguish followed, in which he felt something, quote, cutting or hard, grasp me around the heart. In the morning, he resolved to persevere, and shortly after to accept Mill's anguished offer of money to sustain him through the unexpected additional time he'd need to complete the work. Again, one has the impression that Carlyle, more feeling than he sometimes let on, did this at least as much out of a wish to be tender to Mill's burden of guilt as of a need to pay his bills, although his need to pay bills was notoriously often there. He proceeded to write the first section of Volume 2, go on to the next bit, and then the hard part, we've got to think, don't we, go back to the beginning and start over with Volume 1. Like any of us faced with such a Sisyphean task, he suffered terrible ordeals of doubt, idealizing what had been lost forever to the flames as the irrecoverable original, hundreds of pages, he said, of things that he'd wanted to say, beside which the remembered version he was now writing was merely a pallid simulacrum, the imposter of necessity. He would write feverishly, but then become blocked by panic. During one period lasting many weeks, capable only of reading what he described as low romances on the couch, the trashiest heap of novels available. In late spring, he consigned the rewrite to a drawer, calling it a mass of unformed rubbish. With the summer of 1835 came a renewed burst of energy to replace what he always described to his brother Jack, who possibly unfeelingly was giving Carlyle a vivid description of the eruption of Pompeii. Thomas described what he was returning to as his was something that tried to recover his poor, quote, poor burnt manuscript. By the end of August 1835, he'd finished, went to see his family in Scotland, watched the tale of Halley's Comet, and sent, finally, the manuscript to Mill, who'd understandably kept his distance from Cheyne Row for some time, to read. Mill would indeed read it and praise what he called the prose poem to the skies, both to Carlyle and in print, when he reviewed the publication in 1837. Conflict of interest, sort of, I suppose. How much that review was an act of reparation or the truthful judgment of friend and editor, neither of them would ever be able to judge. But for both of them, the saga of destruction in flame and rebirth, the word phoenix, as Carlyle called it, had a very particular significance, of course. One would never know what the first manuscript of Volume 1 was like. It seems unlikely that the book, as actually rewritten, was some sort of pale ghost of its original, for it spoke with unrepentant literary aggression against the conventions, even the romantic conventions of the day. The weird sublimity, the drug rush hyperbole, the manifold transgressions against grammar, syntax, word order, the confrontational lapel-grabbing relationship with the reader, oh, beloved brother, blockhead, the ecstatic ejaculations and fulminations, the wild and wandering digressions, all of which had already made Carlyle absolutely unsellably notorious, or at least a very acquired taste, were richly and astonishingly and exuberantly there. How about this for the procession of the Estates General? Yes, in that silent marching mass there lies futurity enough. No symbolic ark like the old Hebrews do these men bear. Yet with them too is a covenant. They too preside a new era in the history of men. The whole future is over there, and destiny dim brooding over it. In the hearts and unshaped thoughts of these men it lies illegible, inevitable. Singular to think they have it in them. Yet not they, not mortal, only the eye above can read it, as it shall itself unfold in fire and thunder, in siege, in field artillery, in the rustling of battle banners, the tramp of hosts, the glow of burning cities, the shriek of strangled nations. Well, you know, steady on, you might be saying. And it was Mill who, after reading Sartor Resartus, which it's safe to say, much more than the French Revolution, was not John Stuart's Mill cup of tea, and after trying to edit Carlyle's long essays on Cagliostro and the Diamond Necklace, tried to actually steady Carlyle in a way which would make him more acceptable to what Mill understood or predicted would be the reception of the book, without losing everything that Carlyle wanted to do, his sort of confrontational rejection of Johnsonian, Gibbonian kind of writing. He was also conscious, Mill was very conscious, as was Carlyle, of another friend, Lord Jeffreys' advice to Carlyle that he should simply really try, wonderful phrase of Jeffreys, to try and write like a gentleman. There's a futile piece of counsel, I think. Here's a typical passage of Cagliostro that Mill was literally trying to help Carlyle reshape. Meanwhile, gleams of muddy light will occasionally visit all mortals. Every living creature, according to Milton, the very devil, has some more or less faint resemblance of a conscience, must make inwardly certain auricular confessions, absolutions, professions of faith, were it only that he does not yet quite loathe and so proceed to hang himself. What such a porcus as Cagliostro might specially feel and think and be were difficult in any case to say, much more when contradiction and mystification designed and unavoidable so involve the matter. Here's what Mill wrote about that passage. About that Cagliostro, it has frequently occurred to me of late, as of Teufeldreck from Sartor Resartus, to ask myself, and also you, whether that mode of writing between sarcasm or irony and earnest be really deserving of so much honour as you give it, by making use of it so frequently. The same doubt has occasionally occurred to me respecting much of your phraseology, which fails to bring home your meaning to the comprehension of most readers, so well as would perhaps be done by commoner and more familiar phrases. The style would often tell better on the reader if what is said in abrupt, exclamatory, interjectional manner were said in the ordinary grammatical mode of nominative and verb. No surgeon, Carlyle wrote back to Mill, no surgeon can touch the sore places in a softer hand than you do. And then he said, I daily reflect on this with great sorrow, but it is not a quarrel of my seeking. I mean that a common English mode of writing has to do with what I call the hearsay of things. And the great business for me, in which I alone feel any comfort, is recording the presence, bodily, concrete, coloured presence of things, for which the nominative and verb, as I find here and now, refuse to stand me instead. What Carlyle was aiming at, he made clear to Mill, was to write prose poetry because the matter of history was too profound, too cosmically disorderly to be confined to the utilitarian neatness habitual to those whom Carlyle derisively called the cause and effect people. The right history of the French Revolution, he wrote to Mill in 1833, would be the grand poem of our times. And the man who would write the truth of that were worth all other writers and singers. This is before he got to write it, try it himself. Mill warned Carlyle that if he persisted, he'd face a rough ride. For the prejudices of our utilitarians are at least as strong against some of your writings as those of any person whatever. But Carlyle protested it was the only way he knew, and the only way he wished to impart and enact history. He knew he'd offend every convention of literary decency, but in the spirit of the romantics he revered, like Schiller, Jean-Paul Richter, and Schlegel, unruly, violent energy registered the upheaval, sort of was imprinted with it, like the geological freezing of volcanic forces, sort of petrification of that kind of primordial violence. He wanted to find a writing that would, as he understood it, that would register the colossal quality of historical outcomes. Carlyle told himself, and this is beautiful, I think, actually, this is his own way of describing it, he told himself that if the things come out from the right place, I say to myself, it will go to the right place. It is a simple plan, this, but a desperate one. In the end, Mill had no choice but to accept Carlyle's reinvention of historical voice, at least to the extent of using, in his enthusiastic review of the French Revolution, precisely the term epic prose poem that had made him scratch his head in the first place. Other guardians of the way history and prose writing more generally ought to be written, like John Sterling, usually a good friend of Carlyle's and a sympathiser, remained decidedly unentranced, objecting, this is Sterling, to the headlong capriciousness, the lawless oddity, the strange heterogeneous combination of allusion. Carlyle's style, Sterling said, was positively barbarous, and his neologisms, Sterling, who was the editor of the Athenaeum, specially hated. He hated, here's a Carlyle neologism, environment. He also hated complected, maybe more with more reason, and visualized as the affectations, Sterling thought, of a willful obscurantist. Carlyle wrote back to Sterling that if one has thoughts not hitherto uttered in English books, I see nothing for it but you must use words not found there. You must make words. Sterling, like many other critics, thought it was Carlyle's immersion in German literature that produced the interminable sentences, the prodigious superabundance of expression, which gave it its harshness and strangeness. Sterling again, the jerking and spasmodic violence, the painful subjective excitement. Then, after putting, really, his 18th century histoire philosophique through the sort of filter of much more fiery Calvinism, Carlyle very importantly read Homer. And his convictions, he came to Homer very late, his convictions about the polite artificiality of most of that histoire philosophique only strengthened. Partly, this was because he believed that the recounting of history was an instinctive, ubiquitous, even, as he once said, involuntary human act. A talent of history may be said to be born with us, our chief inheritance. In certain sense, all men are historians. Is not every memory written quite full with annals where joy and mourning, conquest and loss manifoldly alternate? There is no recounting of an hour, a day, a year, Carlyle thought and said, which does not take the form of historical narration, be the subject paltry or grand. Our very speech, he wrote, is curiously historical. Most men, you may observe, speak only to narrate, not in imparting what they have thought, which is indeed very often a small matter, but in exhibiting what they have undergone and seen, which is a quite unlimited one. Cut us off from narrative, how would the stream of conversation, even among the wisest, languish into the detached? Thus, as we do nothing but enact it, we say little but recite it. Since our lives, Carlyle thought, are constructed in such narrations of a verbal, improvised, and undecorous kind, so should the history of public deeds and great matters preserve that spark of a naturally, instinctively, untutored report. Conventional decorous prose, he believed, was the opposite from the broken-faceted literary vitalism he was groping his way towards, being just the serviceable prose of cerebral self-confirmation. It would be writers who abandon themselves more freely to the flux, to the dense plenitude of the human past, its ungovernable commotion, who somehow battled their way to a style that truly registered inchoate turbulence, who would more easily bring together the magic moment and the rolling of the eons. In 1830, 2 years after Thomas De Quincey had pronounced the art of rhetoric in English prose writing dead, Carlyle published the first of 2 essays on history, setting out what ought to be expected of it. Above all, he attacked the self-referentiality of most historical language, its mistaken supposition that submitting the particular to some predetermination of the general was tantamount to the assignment of significance. Here's Carlyle in one of those essays. Alas, do our chains and chainlets of causes and effects, which we owe so assiduously track through certain handbreadths, years, square miles, when the whole is a broad, deep immensity, each atom chained and complected with all. Truly, if it is philosophy teaching by experience, the writer fitted to compose it is hitherto an unknown man. Better it were that mere earthly histories should lower such pretensions, more suitable for omniscience than human science. And, different aim for history, and aiming only at some picture of things acted, which picture itself will at best be a poor approximation. Well, this is all, you know, this more modest proposal for history is deeply disingenuous. The satisfaction of merely painting a picture of things acted. In fact, of course, Carlyle is proposing a titanic ambition to reinvent history entirely. For if the first job was dense picturing, the Enlightenment loftiness would have to go. When you read Gibbon, you heard him and him only. Now, to be sure, you certainly heard Thomas Carlyle in his work. But when he got to work using every tool in the repertoire of sensuous memory, music, smell, colour, texture, you heard everyone else too. And the din was meant to be transporting. Here's, I'm afraid, a long passage which I'm going to read. Forgive me. It's fun, I think, because I want to look at what Carlyle does in this particular passage in just a second, in terms of that ostensibly modest aim of history picturing rather than the causes chained together. So here's what's happening in July 1789. See Camille Desmoulins from the Café de Foire rushing out, sibylline in face, his hair streaming, in each hand a pistol. He springs to a table. The police satellites are eyeing him. Alive they shall not take him. Not they alive, him alive. This time he speaks without stammering. should be without stammering. This time he speaks without stammering. Friends, shall we die like hunted hares, like sheep hounded into their penfold, bleating for mercy when there is no mercy, but only a whetted knife? The hour is come, the supreme hour of Frenchman a man, when oppressors are to try conclusions with oppressed. And the word is swift death or deliverance forever. Let such hour be welcome. Us, meseems, one cry only befits to arms. Let universal Paris, universal France, as with the throat of the whirlwind, sound only to arms, yell responsive, the innumerable voices like one great voice, as if of a demon yelling from the air. For all faces wax fire-eyed, all hearts burst into madness. In such or fitter words does Camille evoke the elemental powers in this great moment. Friends, continues Camille, some rallying side, cockades, green ones, the colour of hope. As with the flight of locusts, those green tree leaves, green ribbons from their neighbouring shops, all green things are snatched and made cockades of. Camille descends from his table, stifled with embraces, wetted with tears, has a bit of green ribbon handed him, sticks it in his hat. It's not Joyce, it's Thomas Carlyle. Now, aside from Carlyle's cosmic interpolations that, as you hear, come fast and furious, the long passage does seem to me do everything that he promises, like it or not. It propels the reader abruptly into the immediate physical presence of the event, as the French Revolution does from the very first rather amazing sentences of the first page. It heightens the effect by the conscious use of poetic devices, the aspirate, the alliteration of hunted hare, spondees were a speciality, although not in this case, the inversions and repetitions that convey precisely the breathless, deathless self-dramatization of revolutionary protagonists. So inversions, alive they shall not take him, not they alive, him alive. We, by the way, always have to supply the commas and the punctuation that make voiced sense of that, as if Carlyle wants us to read history out loud, as seems to be very much the case. Carlyle certainly knew that the mythology about Herodotus actually reading his own histories out loud in Athens. Some of this kind of broken speech actually reenacts, very importantly, Desmoulins' imperfect conversion from stammerer to orator. The melodramatic sententiousness, swift death or deliverance forever. That, of course, is absolutely authentic to the moment of these great events in the Palais Royal, because the Palais Royal on the 12th and the 14th of July is, of course, a site of theatre and burlesques, as well as political speech-making. Carlyle's feel for expressive etymology, often very, very cunning. For example, he italicizes on the page the well in welcome, preserving and reinforcing the precise semantic load of bienvenue. And then not least, there's the sort of organic vitalism, usually by metaphorical indirection, a spectacular vision at once close-up and panoramic, the city swarm, a huge, sudden pullulation, the snatch of leaves to use as cockades, an unstoppable mass of voracious creatures taking to the air, the flight of locusts. They could go on further, just without one passage, to show all the extraordinary things that Carlyle gets up to. Amazing richness of utterance, complexity of strategy that make comparisons at some point with Carlyle's idols, Milton and Dante, not completely ridiculous. What Carlyle's done here, and in much of his historical writing, is to replace what he takes to be the falsely contrived persona of the Olympian, dispassionate Olympian narrator with the impassioned oracular poet Bard, a modern Herodotus or Livy, a persona unembarrassed to become part of the action himself, a Protean companion in written speech who in turn may dissolve himself into the protagonist, in this case the imperfectly converted stammerer Desmoulins, only to reemerge in a little later on as a kind of choric stage director, the most famous sentence, so hangs it, dubious, fateful in the sultry days of July, or another famous passage, on then On all Frenchmen that have hearts in your bodies, roar with all your throats of cartilage and metal, you sons of liberty. Or this about the September massacres and the uneasy relationship between atrocity and the words that must inadequately convey their report as judicial interlocutor. Here's a famous way of dealing with literally something that resists verbalization, an atrocity that horrible. That a shriek of inarticulate horror rose over this thing. He calls it, I think, deliberately, with a deliberate recoil from actually having any description of what the September massacres in our horror amount to. So it's called The Thing. Rose over this thing, not only from French aristocrats and moderates, but from all Europe, and has prolonged itself to the present day, was most natural and right. The thing lay down, irrevocable, a thing to be counted beside some other things that lie very black, which lie very black in our earth's annals, yet which will not erase therefrom. Well may mankind shriek inarticulately, anathematizing as they can. There are actions of such emphasis that no shrieking can be too emphatic for them. Shriek ye, acted have they. Sometimes I think, actually, of course, you know, what Carlyle really missed was the kind of writing that we think of in strong evidence in Poe, in Hawthorne, particularly in Hawthorne, Melville, and I guess Whitman, the sense of actually what they might have found themselves in common with Carlyle was the necessity of cutting off from what they thought was British literary decorum. There's no evidence that Carlyle ever read Hawthorne, for example. Since Hawthorne was in Liverpool, you'd rather hope he might have done, but we don't know. But his own oracular, broken, encyclopedic, heterogeneous manner might have drawn him to some of those writers. But it's maybe not too much, and people writing about Carlyle have pondered this, whether or not some of the American writers owed something to their reading of Carlyle. Because we know they all read him. They all read him, even if he didn't read them. The most eloquent tribute of what might be an unlikely kinship that Carlyle helped American writers to be liberated from English politeness came from Henry David Thoreau, who read the complete works while living in the Hermitage up the road in Walden Pond between 1845 and 47. It was, of course, Emerson who'd given Thoreau the complete works of Carlyle and told Thoreau as well how badly received so many of them been, Sartor Resartus above all. Thoreau wrote he knew very well the kind of aged and critical eye that would make neither head nor tail of Carlyle's style, which to them, the aged critics, seemed to abound, this is Thoreau, only in obstinate mannerisms, Germanisms, whimsical ravings of all kinds. We hardly know an old man to whom these volumes are not hopelessly sealed. Lovely Thoreau description. But Thoreau, so interestingly, took Carlyle's language not as something sort of histrionic, artificial, but as natural as the rough New England countryside to which Thoreau actually compared it. Thoreau said it was the only thing, Carlyle's writing, worthwhile to have come out of England since Wordsworth and Coleridge. The language, this is Thoreau again, they say is foolishness and a stumbling block to again, the aged critics. But to many a clear-headed boy, they are the plainest English and dispatched with such hasty relish as bread and milk. Not one obscure line or half-line did Carlyle ever write. His meaning lies plain as daylight, and he who runs may read. Indeed, only he who runs and can read will keep up with the meaning. Thoreau's perception of what Carlyle wanted to do with the language, but also to literary culture and the Anglophone world, was accurate, at least about Carlyle's aims. In 1838, a year after the French Revolution appeared, Carlyle published a long essay on Scott, ostensibly a review of John Gibson Lockhart's seven-volume biography and vindication of his, Lockhart's, father-in-law. Carlyle's piece was mostly a merciless put-down of Lockhart, whose book on Burns, actually, he'd earlier praised. And actually, it's a complicated relationship between Carlyle and Scott. Carlyle, it's almost like one of these Hollywood movies when, you know, the director wants to create instant Victorian London, has two people in high hats passing each other in the street, and all they say is, "Morning, Thackeray," and the other one says, "Morning, Dickens." Everybody sort of passes somehow through Carlyle's ken, and one of them was Goethe, of course, famously. Goethe had given, earlier, goodness, in the 1820s, had given Carlyle two medals to give to Walter Scott. And at that time, actually, Carlyle wrote Scott a letter of craven obsequiousness, really. But Scott had just, no, it's got to be a bit later, help me out. Scott had just left to live London, to live in Naples in the last attempt to try rescue his health. So Carlyle never met Scott, and there was no reply, and this sort of thing could get up, could affect Carlyle's. But it's fair to say that I think even if they had met, what Scott represented was a sort of not the kind of historical novelization in which you would have much faith. He reacted strongly against the sense in which Scott's enormous popularity, he thought, essentially desiccated the sort of living body of history rather than the reverse. He certainly felt this way by the time he got to review in 1838 the Lockhart magnum opus. So Carlyle then rather mischievously comments on the copiousness of the Lockhart book. He says, "There is a great discovery still to be made in literature, that of paying literary men by the quantity they do not write," in which case Carlyle would have been a lot worse off than he actually was, "than the damning faint praise of Lockhart. Lockhart," he said, "has accomplished the work he schemed for himself in a creditable, workmanlike manner. It's true that his notion of what the work was does not seem to have been very elevated. To picture forth the life of Scott according to any rules of art or composition, so a reader might say to himself, 'There is Scott, there is the physiognomy and meaning of Scott's appearance and transit on this earth. Such was he by nature, so did the world act on him, so he on the world.' All this was by no means Mr. Lockhart's plan." But then, of course, you know, just not being able to stop there, Carlyle goes on to skewer poor dead Scott as an exemplum of what a serious writer and serious writing ought not to be. Scott, in effect, was irredeemably prosaic, led by ambitions that were entirely worldly, content to lie merely on the surface. Bad thing, as you've heard. His power, Scott's power of representing things, his poetic power, like his moral power, was a genius in extenso, as we may say, not intenso. In action, speculation, broad as he was, he rose nowhere high. Productive without measure as to quantity, in quality he, for the most part, transcended but a little way the region of commonplace. It has been said no man has written as many volumes with so few sentences that can be quoted. Winged words were not his vocation. This was the way, then, that Thomas Carlyle taught to Britain to summon the past, to upbraid the present for its vain, shallow sense of time, to attack the vainglorious quality of its self-admiration, the same quality he had detected in Gibbon, that he diagnosed above all as a kind of moral indolence, a failure of the shared imagination. He said the same thing really about Voltaire, in another withering essay about Voltaire and indeed about the Enlightenment overall. It was that complacency, the thin-lipped smugness he detected on Voltaire, whose histories he thought were particularly appalling, that they brimmed with a kind of meretricious familiarity with their subject. The natural medium, it's interesting that Carlyle, however hostile and withering he was about Scott, imported famously from the great prefaces, actually, to the Waverley novels, so the epistles, as Scott called them, that the figure of Dr. Jonas Dryasdust, who taken, wrenched out of the body of Scott, then became the pure example of how not to make contact with history. The natural medium of Dryasdust was a kind of airless false communion. It was the unearned sense of being close to your sources. The antidote to that fake or pseudo familiarity was I think what he then comes to do in that great preface to Cromwell, with which I started, and you'll be happy to hear I'm ending, the immediate confession to the difficulty, to the intransigent nature of getting to proximity, the inaccessibility, the rejection of easy familiarity, the irremediable strangeness of the past. And I just want to end with what he says so magnificently, I think, anyway, for those of us who have attempted to work on the 17th century, of the inexorable remoteness, really, of much of that world. The thing we have to say and repeat was this, that Puritanism is not of the 19th century, but of the 17th, that the grand unintelligibility for us lies there. The fast day sermons of St. Margaret's Church, Westminster, in spite of printers, are all grown dumb in long rows of little dumpy quartos, gathered from the bookstalls. They indeed stand here, bodily before us. By human volition, they can be read, but not by our human memory. Remember them. We forget them as soon as they are read. They become weary to the soul of man. They are dead and gone, and what they shadowed. And again, he describes the kind of sources without which it's impossible to start working on Cromwell and the Puritans, but how far, how difficult, what are the tools that one can have to actually engineer at least a sense of being close to the sources, simply be reading and understanding them all over again. Behold, he says, of the same sources on Puritanism, the same documents, the same sermons and speeches and prayers. Behold, they have become inarticulate quartos, spectral. Instead of speaking, do but screech and gibber. All Puritanism has grown inarticulate. Its fervent preachings, prayings, pamphleteerings are sunk into one indiscriminate moaning hum, mournful as the voice of subterranean winds. So much falls silent. Human speech, unless by rare chance it touch on the eternal melody and harmonize with them, human action, interest, if divorced from those eternal melodies, sinks all silent. And it's with that unlikely respect for silence that I will shut both Carlyle up and myself. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Columbia University Professor Simon Sciama. Professor Sciama's lecture was titled Carlyle and the Morality of Exuberance, and it was presented by the Boston University Humanities Foundation. Tonight's introduction was made by Humanities Foundation Director James Wynn. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney, with help from Alden Fertig and Ian Kennedy. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.